Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting here with Sarah McJulie, and we're across from one of our favourite authors, and we're quite excited by it, Michael Robotham, who's come to talk about The Other Wife, his new book, which is awesome. Yay. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, guys.
We both read this, and cover to cover, and we adore it, and we think it's probably your best, or I'm going to say it on I think it's your best.
I do too, but I literally think that every time a new book of yours comes out, so I feel like I'm just, everyone's better.
That's really nice you say that, because my entire career has been predicated on the belief that every time I finish a book, this is going to be the book that shows the fact that I'm a complete fraud and don't know what I'm doing.
I scoff.
And so I deliver it thinking, yeah, they're going to discover that I don't know what I'm doing. I've got away with it. I've been very lucky up until now. And this one was no different. I actually thought, oh, they're not going to like it.
That's so crazy. But that fear is obviously working as part of your creative process.
I think you
process.
Can do it too, yeah. Fear of failure, I think, is a great motivation.
So what can we say about the book? Like, where do you allow us to go in discussion of the book? If you're going to give us parameters as to what should be shared with an audience.
Well, I mean, it's a Joe O'Loughlin book, and for obviously, I mean, he's my most enduring character, the clinical psychologist, the man with a brilliant mind and a crumbling body. And it's probably the most personal story I've ever tackled, because this is a story about families and grief and fathers and sons, in particular Joe's relationship with his father. And in a sense, it mirrors a little about my relationship with my father. But I guess, you know, the simplest hook for this book is the fact that Joe is summoned to hospital by word that his news that his father has been attacked and is in a coma, having undergone brain surgery. And he asks, you know, where's my mother? And is told that his mother is with him. And so he gets to the ICU, and Joe finds a strange woman beside his father's bed. And when he says, "Who are you?" she says, "I'm his other wife."
That's so amazing.
Such a great opening. It just brings, and to have, like, because the initial response is, what is this nutcase doing here? You know, that's the initial response.
Joe's father, William O'Loughlin, you know, is a celebrated surgeon, you know, retired surgeon, but a man who is a medical giant in the UK. And so Joe has spent his entire life being, I guess, you know, in awe of his father, terrified by his father, deeply respectful of what his father has done. But everything that he has grown up to believe about this man is suddenly thrown into turmoil by this strange woman. And he doesn't know whether she's a fantasist, or whether she is a killer, or whether she's telling the truth. So it's a deeply traumatic moment. I mean, it's traumatic to see his father, you know, on the edge of death, but then to discover these things makes it doubly so.
So, Michael, tell us about your father.
I guess, I mean, my father is nothing like... my father died 10 years ago. And when I say he's nothing like William O'Loughlin, you know, he was a headmaster of country high schools and a teacher. But I guess I had an interesting relationship with my father. He was a tremendously wonderful father, but he was also a man that I spent my entire life trying to impress, you know, and he was a man of his generation. He didn't praise his children. You know, he didn't ever sort of say that he loved you, you know, you know, I'd often hear from my mother that, you know, my dad was the sort of guy who would brag to his mates in the pub and on the golf course about what his children were doing, but he would never say anything to his children. So I spent my entire life as a journalist and a ghostwriter and then as an author trying to impress him. And I remember when he died, my initial reaction was I didn't know who I was writing for anymore, because I'd spent every book I'd sent to him in the hope that he would say, "I'm really proud of you, and I think what you've done is remarkable." And I know he thought that, and I know he believed that, but he never said it, you know. And that's why I remember it took me a long while after he died, because I didn't know who I was writing for anymore. I didn't know, you know, who I was trying to impress. And you know, you get past that and realize that you're just writing for yourself.
So this was in this last period, you've written some standalone novels, you've gone in different directions. Is that any relation to this, Who Am I Writing For?
No,
different to his?
No, I don't know. I think it, I mean, the very last book he got a chance to read was quite early on. I mean, he died 10 years ago. So, you know, I think, you know.
This all your career is, like, all this success has been quite in the last period, hasn't it? I mean, I think of you as writing for decades.
Yeah. No, it's really, this is, I think, The Other Wife is book number lucky 13. And it's for 2004 is when The Suspect, the first Joel Lochlin book, was published. So it's 14 years, 13 books in 14 years. but, you know, I think each time, I mean, I still think about him when I finish the book and think, you know, and it's quite funny. I mean, my mum is the same. I love it a bit, you know. I love telling people that, you know, I mean, my mother, when people say to her, hasn't Michael done well, she will say, all my children have done well, you know, which is lovely, you know. And my famous story of her is when I sent her an advance reading copy of my first book, and I waited and I waited and I heard nothing from her, and I was just desperately, you know, worried that she hated it. And I said, Mum, did you get a chance to read that book with my name in huge type on the front? And she said, oh, dear, I had three library books to get through. Did you want me to read your one first? And then later when she got, again, I had to phone her and said, Mum, have you finished it yet? She said, yes. I said, what did you think? She said, well, it took me a while to get into, but then I did. And I wanted to put that on my website beneath the Washington Post review and the New York Times review. Author's mother. Took me a while to get into, but then I did. You know, and I know I love it a bits and all that, but that's the generation they were. Yeah. I mean, and the odd thing is, you know, anyone with children knows is that, you know, particularly anyone my age, is your parents might have been like that. But when they become grandparents, oh, they lavish their grandchildren with the most astonishing praise and they can do no wrong. And a little part of you, being the sons, you think, you know, why didn't you ever do that for us? You know, you do it for your grandchildren. They can, you know, you just tell them all the time that you love them and that painting is the best painting you've ever seen and whatnot. But, you know, it's almost like it skips a generation.
I think the grandkids just get the parents serving of love.
You know, and that's not to say, you know, I had the most wonderful childhood and I didn't want for anything. We weren't rich, but we had lots of sort of love. But it's just an interesting dynamic.
So how do you let that inform this book? How do you manage to, because this, the family stuff in this book is just so juicy. Like it's just, and it's so well described and so, it affects me in so many different ways as I read it. And the strange thing is, this is what I said in my review as well, is there's so much detail in all this stuff and I get so much understanding of these relationships and yet I'm racing through the book. Like I am turning the page at a million miles an hour to find out what happens, but I'm also getting this incredible emotional ride. And
you just don't get it that often. Usually it weighs, like all good books usually weigh sort of a little bit more towards character-driven or a little bit more towards plot-driven, but this is just, you nailed it on both sides.
I think, well, thank you. It's nice of you to say. I mean, I don't like writing plot, which is a strange confession to make. It's the bit I don't like about writing. I love the characters and their relationships, and that's the bit I love most. But you sort of got to be aware, you know, that you need both. You need a story to go with it. And in a sense, you know, and I think I've probably said this before to you guys when you've interviewed me before, but the three words that drive me always is make them care, is to make the reader care about my characters and then do terrible things to them. No,
yeah.
But no,
yes, that's
in a sense, you put them under pressure. Like yeah. You fall, you know, you make them fall in love and then you... So much thinking, what's the worst thing that could happen now, you know? And Joe O'Loughlin is, you know, he's a character I adore and he's been with me for 8 or 9 books. But I've done terrible things to him, you know,
yeah,
and I've put him under enormous pressure and he's lost a lot. And he shows great humanity. And he is, I guess, in terms of wish fulfillment as a writer, he's cleverer than I am. He's more, you know, he is braver than I am. And of all my characters, he's probably, apart from that, the most autobiographical in the sense that we both have daughters and we both regard family as the most important thing in our lives. And you know, even it's funny, even in the very first book when I created Joe and I introduced his father, who Joe referred to as God's personal physician in waiting, because, you know, he was a celebrated surgeon. Even then I had my own father in mind when I wrote about Joe's father. And there's a scene in that book where it was almost wish fulfillment that it was a scene that I wished that I'd shared with my dad before he left.
Oh.
You managed to do what authors tend to avoid, and you've created a character that has a profession that requires years and years of study and then it's constantly changing and updating as well, so you have to be on the ball with this stuff. Do you, like, are you like one of those poor NRMA guys that have to get retrained and retrained and retrained?
A clinical psychologist at this point?
How do you keep up with what's going on, and how do you even understand it? You know, some of the stuff that's going on with modern science and modern, it just seems like a lot of pressure to put on an author for, like, do you regret that decision at any time?
I think I was lucky in choosing psychology, because things like forensic science have changed. I mean, you know, I feel sorry for those crime writers that base their books around science, because, you know, by the time they realise there's been some new breakthrough, you know, CSI has done it months earlier on the TV show or whatever. I mean, it's very hard to keep up. With psychology, even though there is a whole lot of behavioural science work going on all the time, most of the major principles are known, and in terms of particularly when it comes to criminal psychology, in terms of the sort of things that create dysfunction and violence, and, you know, the fact that society, in a sense, gets the monsters it deserves, because most of the people that commit terrible crimes didn't spring from nowhere. They came out of, you know, dysfunctional families and, you know, and childhoods that were full of violence and deprivation and whatever. Not always, but in most cases. So I guess I have that advantage that I tend to stick to those sort of parameters, really. And most of my villains and the people that commit these crimes in my books, I think what I've tried really hard to do in each one is for them to be a reason. There's a reason why they do those things. They're not just simply the villain born evil, and it's never explained why they do the things they do. I try to give them a motivation that the reader can understand. It doesn't forgive them, but it does explain what they do.
Well, that comes across so clearly, because when you read one of your books, particularly with this book, I feel there's no character, however small, that doesn't have a fully formed character that you can get. Even if it's just that maybe Joe uses that insight that he has to just completely, like, write off a person's character in like two or three lines. But in so doing, you've given the reader this fully formed character that until then was just, like, you know, unformed.
It's Joe's superpower.
Yeah, it's so cool. I love it when he does that.
It's Sherlockian, isn't it? Yeah. It's that idea of you suddenly, you know, and again, well, this, you know, goes back to, you know, when I was a ghostwriter, I worked with a man called Paul Britton, who was a clinical psychologist who worked in the forensic world, and he was the man that Cracker was based upon, that remarkable, mm-hmm. you know, BBC series. And Paul had this ability to look at someone and the way they're dressed and the way they sit and the way they're groomed, you know, how they hold themselves, how they walk through a door, and to know so much about them in the space of just a glimpse. And in a sense, I've tried to give Joe Lachlan that same sort of ability, where he will look at them and within a very short space of time know exactly, you know, right down to their level of education, you know, how much they spend on personal grooming, what sort of lifestyle they have, you know, whether there's that stain on their shirt or lipstick on their collar or mud on their shoes, whether they have a pet or don't have a pet, all these things that you, that he picks up incredibly quickly.
So disconcerting, but so great.
and it's a lesson for wannabe writers as well, because it, one of the things that, you know, if you're studying other writers as an emerging writer, you've got to train yourself to sort of pick up these tricks, because sometimes it's about five lines that suddenly those perfectly chosen points about their person and what they've done.
Yeah.
We fill in the rest.
I think it's particularly important with smaller characters, because what can happen, I always remember one of my favourite Hemingway lines, and it's a description, and it's someone, he describes someone as having a dimple deep enough to drop a marble into.
Oh.
Now, it does not matter whether that character does not appear again for 200 pages. The moment they appear, you just think, the dimple. Do you know what I mean? And it's how you, and particularly with the peripheral characters, sometimes you realise they're not going to play a major role in the book, but you have to describe them well enough in a short space of time that they will stay with the reader and the reader will know that character and hold them in their mind when they turn up further down the book. And it is that case of... I firmly believe, you know, it goes back to the journalistic training, that if you can describe someone in five lines, then that's surely beautiful, hopefully describe them very well in five lines, then that's a lot better than spending a page and a half doing it, because the page and a half is what Elmer Leonard would refer to as the bit of the book that rattles, and the bit that, you know, people are thinking, okay, we've got this, move on. But if you do it well enough, you just think you've planted that seed, or buried that landmine, as I like to say, and then somewhere down the track, the reader is going to step on it, and they're going to remember that you planted it, but they're not going to actually see it coming.
We had Ramity Feist in here the other day, and he was talking about writers' muscle memory. Like he said, I've done 30 books over 30 years, and he said, you know, these things now. A part of the profession that I'm involved in, making sure that the book is flowing as I'm writing it, and the people are turning pages, isn't something I'm consciously thinking of anymore. And he just knows. Are you still in that conscious mode where you're?
I think every time I start a new book, I think that I've forgotten everything I've ever learned, and I'm a complete novice. Although it's not, you know, in the end, it's not complete. I remember when I, you know, one of my favourite books is Stephen King's book On Writing, which is sort of part memoir and part sort of how-to guide. And I only read that after I'd written my first novel. And what he managed to do in that book was to put into words a whole lot of things that I'd done completely instinctively. And he explained in that book exactly how you build suspense by withholding information and... You know, it's a bit like, you know, the difference between surprise and suspense. You know, surprise being when a bomb goes off. Suspense is when you show the reader the bomb and then you hold them there and they know it's there. That is suspense. And all those things which I could never have explained, he put into words. I think I now understand why I do the things I do. When it comes to things like the pace of the storytelling, I think for me it comes from the fact that when I'm writing... Because I'm sure all writers see it this way. When I'm writing, it might take me a week to write a couple of scenes. And so in my head, I'm thinking, oh my God, this book is so slow, you know, and because I forget to realize, you know, that obviously a reader is going to read that in the space of one night. So what I think is desperately slow, they're going to think is in, you know, and it's not until I finish the first draft when I think, and by that point I'm thinking, this is the slowest, most plodding book in the history of the world. And then I go back and read it and I think, no, that has pace because, you know, and that just comes from the fact that it obviously takes me longer to write than it takes someone to read. But I do think there are times when, you know, it's a time, I think, where it does come in, where you do think sort of, I suppose, tactically, is where you suddenly think yourself, a particular character has been out of the story too long. I have to put that character back in now. I have to find a way because I have to remind the reader of who they are and what they're doing. Mm. And so that is where it becomes sort of tactical, where you think, you make a note in the margin saying, you know, a new chapter needed, or bring this character back soon.
And you just mentioned Stephen King's book on writing. What's it like now to see, you know, Secret Street Keeps on a nice big banner with a Stephen King quote saying just how awesome it is?
Isn't it lovely? Look, I'm so fortunate. My fourth novel, Shatter, he picked it up completely unbidden. And I remember being in Europe with the family, and and I got a message saying that he'd written a story in Entertainment Weekly magazine or Entertainment News, and he called his number one book of the summer. And I remember being awestruck. And I remember turning to my wife and saying, you know, it would not matter if I did not sell another book ever, because I will, in my dotage, sit in my rocking chair on my front porch, and I will tell people that Stephen King once said I'd written the best book of the summer. You know, that was going to be enough for me. I was just in awe.
Drop the mic and walk out.
I did. It felt like a mic drop. And since then, I think four or five books after, you know, he has, he's always picked up the books and read my new one, and he's, and I now share a publisher with him in America, and I think that's predominantly because of Stephen King. I think, you know, he'd written so many nice things about my books. He turned to his American publisher and sort of said, you know, for God's sake, if you get an opportunity, you know, sign this guy. So it's lovely. I've emailed him. I've never met him. I would love to meet him. Mm. It would be one of the highlights of my life to actually meet him. Mm. But we've emailed, you know, and I've just emailed to thank him. And he always emails back and saying, no, 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 I should be thanking you, which is so sweet.
That blows my mind.
Yeah. Michael, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. We always sort of glean a little bit more about how this process and how you managed to do this magic. Congrats on this book. As I said at the beginning, we just loved it, absolutely loved it. It does so many things, and yet still does the thing that people are going to pay the money for, which is speed me through this, excite me, do all the thriller stuff. But they just get all this extra free stuff, which is just this richness and depth of character, which is just gorgeous.
Thank you. Thank you very much. No, it's funny. I think that's the, as a writer, you know, particularly writing in the people often sort of imagine that the crime genre is a plot-driven genre, and yet when you ask them their favourite crime novel, invariably they'll begin tell you about the characters first, because it's equally character-driven, and it's what brings people back time and time again to certain writers if they fall in love with the characters. So that's enormously gratifying that you love the book so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you can get all of Michael's books at booktopia.com.au, and some of them are nicely dressed in new jackets, I notice. Get hold of those right now.
Thank you. What a time to rebuy.
Yes, rebuy them all. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.